Hello and welcome to Cybersecurity Matters Podcast. My name is Christian. This is my co-host, Mr. Dominic Vogel. Dominic, tell us who we have in the virtual hot seat today.
Mr. Redshaw, today we have Kelly Shortridge. She is the VP of Product Strategy and Product Management over at Capsulate, which is a security vendor.
Yeah.
She's a fantastic speaker, really interesting person. So
definitely,
this should be a super cool combo.
Yeah, looking forward to it. So we're going to bring Kelly on and we'll be right back.
Kelly, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day to chat with Christian and I. We're really stoked for what I'm sure will be an awesome conversation. So thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you so much for having me, Dominic.
Thanks, Kelly. So tell us, first of all, you're in cybersecurity. What a strange career to choose. Tell us how that came about. What was your career path to get here?
It is a strange career, and for me, it was definitely a strange career path. I actually started my career in investment banking, covering information security as well as data analytics, doing mostly mergers and acquisitions. I then decided to found my own startup, which was later acquired by one of the large cybersecurity companies. And during that time, I realized that I loved the idea of solving real security problems that customers had, which is when I started to go into product management at various security vendors, starting with BAE Systems Applied Intelligence, then on to Security Scorecard, and now at Capsulate, where I'm VP of Product Management and Product Strategy.
So at what point in your life did you decide cybersecurity is the thing that I want to do? Was there a turning point there for you?
So banking was always top of mind for me since I was maybe 11 years old. That's what I wanted to do. But when I started to analyze the InfoSec space, I realized it was just a total mess. There's a ton of irrationality. There's a ton of just market failures, which from an economics background was absolutely fascinating. So I decided that there was enough like broken, messy stuff in the industry that it would be a compelling industry to start, you know, carving a career path.
Awesome. So just kind of parking cybersecurity for a minute, there's another theme in your life and in your career, which is behavioral economics. Can you just tell us what that is in and of itself?
Definitely. So probably some of the audiences had like an economics 101 sort of course. A lot of that is theory. It's nice graphs that go like this and everybody acts totally logically. It's obviously not true in real life. So behavioral economics looks at actual experimental evidence to see how people really behave and how they make their decisions, which I personally love data-driven and evidence-driven approaches. So that's why I like behavioral economics a little more.
Okay. Cool. And so then how does that apply to you now when it comes to the field of cybersecurity? How does that work for you within your current role?
So much. So within my current role, it's sometimes a little less relevant, though I still think for any good product role, you want to be looking at market evidence and customer evidence. But in general, when I look at the security space, I try to always look at like what are the different incentive mechanisms. So for instance, right now, there's kind of an incentive for security to want to maintain control over environments. That's a little bit at odds with, for instance, what DevOps is trying to do, or at least the DevOps movement. So when you start looking at those incentives, you can start better figuring out, okay, how do we fix this? Because if you don't think about how people are actually behaving, what their goals are, what, you know, makes them scared, you aren't going to be able to introduce the right mitigations to get them to actually change their behavior, which in behavioral economics literature is known as choice architecture. So you can think of almost like benevolent manipulation. Some people may have heard the idea of making, for example, like 401ks at an employer, that it's the default is that you're opted in and you have to opt out. That's an example of choice architecture because it's encouraging saving by making adding friction to you removing yourself from the 401k instead of adding yourself. There's a bunch of stuff we can be doing in the security industry kind of in that vein. We just aren't doing it yet.
Kelly, and you know this, I'm a huge fan of yours. I've always loved reading the articles that you write because they're so different compared to, I'd say, 99% of the other security articles that are out there. And
Thank
for
you.
Me, you know, I've been in the industry 15 years, and you know, so many of the problems that were prevalent 15 years ago are still prevalent now, like patch management. That's still a problem.
It is.
So, you know, when like you were saying there's so many systemic things which are still broken. Why is that? You know, again, I'm sure there's multiple reasons into that. You know, from one of my perspectives is that, you know, for the most part, you know, we've still been driven by an IT perspective. There's been relatively little outside thinking to change that. In your mind, you know, what are things that have A, contributed to that, and B, you know, what can the industry as a whole do to actually make progress, even on something like patch management?
It's a great question. I think it again comes back to incentives. I would argue that even though I've given many hot takes about the different ways that the security industry has failed, you know, most security professionals still are getting six-figure salaries. Some CISOs are getting seven-figure salaries. There's not exactly a punishment there.
Yeah.
So at the security industry as a whole, we tend to be pretty well rewarded. We've been able to get away with potentially unprofessional behavior because there just aren't that many of us. So we kind of benefit from the fact that there's at least a perception about scarce supply. I would argue that there's also been an incentive in the security industry to make ourselves indisposable to organizations, to make it seem like security is impossible and arcane and outsiders couldn't possibly comprehend it, because it helps preserve those six-figure and seven-figure salaries.
Yeah.
If we say, oh no, you can actually automate this through like these steps, and actually it's more about process than technology, you start to see kind of like a house of cards tumbling down a little bit. But I think there are just so many factors. Like status quo bias is a huge one. Just, you know, this is how it's always been done. Well, how it's always been done isn't working, but there's enough experimental evidence to show that people tend to mostly think about or prioritize how they've already done things. There's also prospect theory, which I've talked about at length, where people really underestimate the most prevalent threats. They view it as like, oh yeah, phishing. Yeah, we know it exists, but you know, it's not as important as like O-Day, which is maybe, you know, a 1% or 0.1% threat. People are like, well, clearly it's, you know, it needs to be 20% of our budget. So you see a lot of, I would say, different facets that are contributing to the problem. But I think fundamentally is the security industry hasn't really had an impetus for change. Part of what I've been trying to argue is that I think that's going to change in itself. Because frankly, engineers aren't going to tolerate security just adding so much friction anymore. They're going to be able to start implementing more security processes and security solutions themselves. And so I'm hoping that'll be a forcing function.
Well, and one of the interesting things I think that you brought up there was, I mean, to pull on this thread a bit more is, I really hear this from non-technical people as well, is that they have a real tough time separating hype from fact when, you know, they'll get approached from, I guess, from various business owners or various executives who'll say, well, you know, a security vendor X approached us and they said that if we bought their solution, that would solve all of our security problems. And often they'll buy the solution because they don't have the sort of the wherewithal to be able to ask the right questions. I've seen sort of the, again, broadly speaking, the security vendor landscape get progressively worse over the past 15 years in terms of how they take advantage of, again, non-technical people. Again, I know you're talking about, again, there hasn't really been an impetus for change yet, but why has the industry gone down that path? And how dangerous is that right now to have that sort of magic bullet syndrome, which they try to sell to non-technical people?
I think it's incredibly dangerous because I think, honestly, if you look at the security industry today, the smallest fraction of it is really about protecting users. I think there's a lot of just, we've set up a thing that works well for a lot of us to get, you know, wealthy and stay intellectually curious. I would say there are kind of two factors here. Is one is that, again, going back to the actual security programs, they aren't necessarily held to evidence or having to prove like ROI. It's something that's been seen as impossible. I would argue that it is impossible until you start trying to measure it. It's just, there's not really incentive to do so, because what happens if, oh, our budget actually could be half of what it is based on our ROI? It's not something most CISOs want to propose. That means that when they're evaluating security technologies, they aren't asking for evidence from the vendors either. So the vendors don't really have an incentive to change. You see someone like FireEye, for instance, who basically made, at least for a brief period of time, a ton of money, had an enormous valuation. I remember when it was like valued at 14 times revenue. It was shocking, based on like anti-O-Day and, you know, all this fancy like sandbox analysis and all those, you know, buzzwords that are now very passe, but at the time were somewhat revolutionary. You know, and it turns out they never really did anything beyond that. And now they're obviously suffering. But for a time, like, lots of companies bought them and thought that was going to be the silver bullet. But again, they weren't measuring, did this actually help anything? So I think it's kind of, vendors aren't really helping the customers by saying like, hey, we're going to be like honest and transparent here. Here's the evidence you need. Like, here are the actual pros and cons, because that's going to hurt their business, right? And then the security practitioners, the ones who are buying things, aren't measuring the efficacy of their own programs. Mm-hmm. So there isn't necessarily an incentive to go and review like, hey, is this solution actually working for us? In fact, there's potentially an argument somewhat similar to what you hear about in kind of government budget circumstances where they want to justify a bigger and bigger budget. And so they don't necessarily want to get rid of the super expensive tools unless they're absolutely forced to like cap budgets at a certain point. So again, it goes back to there's a mess of incentives here. I definitely think vendors are just totally failing customers. Vendors could absolutely be helping customers, but they instead show things like what a pie chart of like malware strains per month. That doesn't help a security program. It just doesn't. It looks really cool, even though pie charts kind of the bane of my existence. And instead you want to see like, things like how long is it taking you to like remediate a certain vulnerability? Like how long is it taking for you to like restore a system once it's been compromised? But you don't see vendors producing those statistics, which again, kind of means that there's no guidance really for the security practitioners, at least on the vendor side.
Right. Two follow-up questions to that. I know I'm hogging the mic here before I send it back to Christian. The first one is that relationship with vendors and you know buyers. It sounds like there's very much a short-term thinking right now, rather than like long-term thinking, and we're starting to see sort of what I would refer to as sowing seeds of distrust, in which particularly among small and mid-sized organizations, they're very distrustful of any security consultant or security vendor because they've been burned in the past. They spent a ton of money on something which they found out after the fact wasn't a silver bullet. And for us, we routinely run into that. We mainly deal with small and mid-sized organizations, and they're very distrustful. They'll say, "Well, we spent $100K on a security consultant a couple of years ago, we got nothing out of it. Or we spent $100K on some fancy SIM tool, we got nothing out of it." If we get to a certain point where there's that where there's that distrust, but yet small and mid-sized organizations need to actually mature their cybersecurity posture, to me, that sounds like we're creating the perfect environment for cyber criminals.
Yeah, no, I think by far and away, cyber criminals, I would argue, are better at tracking their own success. They're better at implementing like new infrastructure. They're better at maximizing like ROI because they have the incentives to. Like, they don't want to burn money. The classic example I give is like with the GRU, they used phishing on the DNC. They didn't really like drop ODE. They didn't have to. So they're thinking a lot more strategically in some ways about ROI. They were first to adopt like cloud infrastructure way before most CISOs were on board with it because it helped with their like scalability and distribution problems. And again, like they have bosses and budgets. I think as Phil Venable said, they have success metrics, at least at like the somewhat organized scale. Like they can't afford to really get caught. They can't afford to just blow money. So it's part of the reason why I think they have much better processes than on the defense side, which is a shame. But I think you're absolutely right. Like it really benefits cyber criminals with the current paradigm we have, because you can have like AI, whatever network traffic that takes 8 months to learn your environment. Ransomware is still probably going to get through and you're totally screwed as an SMB. Whereas, if you were using, something simple like Chromebooks and mostly like cloud infrastructure, that's going to be a lot harder for ransomware to be effective. Same with basic things like backups. None of that is sexy technology that is advertised a lot in the security industry. Nevertheless, here we are.
Yeah, absolutely. And on that point, and so for small and mid-sized organizations, and you hit on a couple points there, what are some questions or areas of focus that small or mid-sized organizations can focus on to make sure that they're at least doing the basics and doing them well?
Yeah, I think the discussion of basics, that it depends on each organization, but I would say, particularly if you're starting, you're in a position to start reasonably from scratch, as much as it's yet another buzzword, the zero trust paradigm really is beneficial for SMBs just because it removes a ton of headaches, particularly in this sort of environment around just like network access control and everything. You now are just verifying like user identity, maybe looking at things like device health. But you still, something like SSO, you're just making the user experience easier. You're able to like track like application behavior better. Like it's just the simplification you can get from zero trust. Again, if you're starting from the beginning, it's a little trickier to migrate, can be enormously beneficial. Simple things like two-factor authentication can be helpful. Using SaaS apps in general, honestly, a lot of it, if you can reduce complexity as an SMB, you're probably going to be in a better position from a security perspective. Yeah. I think there are also questions you can ask as an SMB of your vendors that are maybe non-traditional. But for instance, you should ask, what's the vendor's NPS score? That's the Net Promoter Score. Duo Security and Thinxt famously talked about theirs because theirs was very good. We don't really hear that from other companies. I suspect it's because it's quite low in general. Yes. So asking questions like that, you can get a better sense of you know, whether customers are happy or not. So it's these, rather than looking at like, you know, the traditional things, like, again, how much are you blocking? What's your false positive rate? Look more to like Net Promoter Score. Ask, you know, depending on the product, like how many customers are running something in blocking mode or not. Try to look to the kind of user experience aspects of the product and how customers are actually feeling about it rather than technological capability. Because honestly, what's the point of a SIM if you don't have time to manage it? You don't have the expertise to figure out like what rules to write. Like it's, you just, you can't deal with it as an SMB. So you need to start looking more to those almost UXy components. But I would argue that it's pretty essential to just, again, maximizing ROI out of your products.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No, that's terrific insight.
I'm not sure how much time we have left, but I do have two questions. Do I have time for both of them? So, Kelly, my first question, you mentioned ransomware before. What would you, as a small business owner, be most concerned about now in terms of cyber threats?
Ooh, that's a good question. Yeah. I mean, phishing in general, like all of the stats and reports I've seen, phishing is still obviously a huge vector. Making sure, honestly, that you're users have really simple stuff like ad blocks in place. Like, again, it's really boring. Trying to think what else, like two-factor authentication is always useful in general. Yeah. And trying to use, like I said, cloud infrastructure as much as possible.
Yeah. Right.
Because, like, even if a user machine gets totally owned, there's no data on the machine. It kind of doesn't matter if there's ransomware. So, again, like trying to have your infrastructure be a little more distributed. Obviously, I've talked a bit in the past about like the DAI paradigm coined by CDLU. But if you have like immutable infrastructure, you're already blocking any attempts to like modify or write to disk. That means ransomware is going to have a really hard time taking hold. It's going to require a lot more effort. If you have ephemeral infrastructure, you can just kill stuff as soon as you see something bad happening. So again, as you, this is why one of my hot takes is that a lot of the biggest security benefits as far as modern security programs actually come from infrastructure rather than security technologies themselves. So I'd focus a lot on your infrastructure, making sure that you have as many like things like two-factor, SSO, like trying to make sure that your credentials present some sort of friction for any attacker if like a username and password is stolen. Beyond that, like try to keep it simple. Like anything that you won't be able to manage isn't going to help your security program.
Okay, cool. So awesome. Last question. Let's land the plane here with this one. So talk to us like we are business owners of a small business that we don't have a clue about technology. We just get up in the morning, we think about profitability. We don't know the difference between IT and cybersecurity. We don't want to know because our IT guy handles that, right? So you mentioned that it's about practices as more than it is about technology. So we always are talking about, you know, people awareness and training, having good, effective policies that are implemented and enforced throughout the organization. And then the technology piece is the third piece for us. So if you were to advise us just in really basic terms, because we don't have a clue, where would we get started strategically with cybersecurity? How should we be thinking about putting cybersecurity in place for our business?
I would say, look at what your business priorities are. What would shut down your business if it happened?
Love it.
Is there a particular server where if it got compromised, you wouldn't be able to make money? Look at how your humans in your organization actually behave. Are you a very sales heavy organization where the sales team needs to be able to present in lots of like customer or prospect meetings? Try to think about what are what are the things that drive revenue? And that's what you need to be protecting. And you need to be protecting them in a way that means that all of your employees can still do the work they need to do in order for you to make money. And any like security technology, security process, security policy that's going to get in the way of you making money probably isn't going to be followed or used. That's just human nature. But you still want to make sure that you are, you know, focusing on the things that matter to your business. And you can kind of forget about the stuff that doesn't. If there's, you know, an example I love to use is like maybe you have a database that has like all of your Slackmoji. Probably don't need to worry about protecting that. It's okay if like criminals get your Slackmoji database. But all of your customer data, maybe you should take a careful look at, you know, talk to your, whoever is your IT person, ask them like whether the, you know, whether it makes sense to move it to like cloud infrastructure. Do you need like everything on premise? Yeah, I think fundamentally it's about how do you make money and making sure that security isn't getting in the way of you making money, because otherwise it won't work.
Mm-hmm. So profitability, but including security in that, and how do you make money? That's what it comes down to. Big hand clap for that answer. That was perfect.
Yeah, business owners will like that. Security people, not so much, because you know everything must be protected. But the truth is, like, we have finite resources. Some things are just fundamentally more important than others.
It's about priority, right?
Exactly.
Absolutely. Kelly, thank you so much. Before we let you go, I'm curious how many books are in that pile behind you, because I've never seen a book pile like that. That's very impressive.
So it's not stacked on its own. I have cats and that would be a disaster. They're actually in color order. You know what? I'm going to guesstimate somewhere like 50 to 60. And then there are tons of other books scattered around the house. It's a mix of like military history, some fiction, some philosophy, also advanced options trading, just for fun.
A bit of night reading.
Yeah. Regardless, that's one of the most impressive book stacks I've ever seen. So thank you again so much for taking the time to chat with Krish and I. We just are very humble and grateful for your time and for your amazing insight. That was awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me and for the great question.
Awesome convo with Kelly. What a powerful speaker and so full of cybersecurity wisdom.
Yes.
Practical for companies. My thing from her was more practice than it is technology. It's more about the processes and practices than it is about that, you know, magic bullet.
Exactly. She's such an engaging personality, very different than the security status quo. Plus, she had a really interesting stack of books.
Yes.
There. So
good visual behind her. That was really cool.
Yeah. What an awesome conversation. That was fantastic having her on our podcast today.
Episode recorded live from New York City. So
live from New York.
looking forward to
cybersecurity matters.
Yeah, exactly. Looking forward to talking to Kelly again. And thanks for watching. You can check out our other podcasts on conversationsthatmatter.tv or anywhere you normally listen to your podcasts. And we will see you next week.